Alrighty, so let's go ahead and turn in our Bibles this morning to Acts chapter 23. Just going to cover a couple of quick things, and then we're going to jump into some of the things that Paul would discuss when he is before Felix. Got a little bit of a supplementary material today concerning Felix, and that we'll cover here a little bit. But as you may remember, Paul, of course, had been arrested by this time. Acts chapter 23 covers most of that information, where he's been arrested in Jerusalem. He has the opportunity to speak to the council. And, of course, during his discussion with the council, he brings up the subject of the resurrection. And it divides. And, of course, Doing so basically causes a bit more of a riot, if you will. And then, of course, there was a conspiracy to kill him. And then eventually, because of this conspiracy that was found out, he was moved to the city of Caesarea. So while he's in Caesarea waiting for his accusers to show up, Felix, of course, is there. And Felix is like, okay, let's do this. Let's get this trial underway. So Paul, at this point, chapter 24, he's going to appear before Felix, the governor, and this is a courtroom. This situation, if you will, kind of think of it like it's a modern day courtroom where you're going to have a prosecutor bringing forth his arguments, and then normally you would have a defendant or defense attorney. And I just broke that. No, actually, just popped off. That's the power of audio editing. We'll take that right out. Okay, so normally you'll have a prosecutor, of course, that'll bring forth his arguments, and then you'll have a defense attorney essentially bringing forth their arguments. And that's the situation that we're going to find ourselves in here, where the accusations are brought against Paul, and then Paul gives his defense. I want to talk a little bit about some of those things as we get to that detail, but one of the interesting things about this, if we go back to Acts chapter 9, may remember that there was a specific prophecy, if you will, made about Paul that is actually being fulfilled here. So Acts chapter 9, this is back, of course, when Ananias is having his discussion with the Lord concerning Paul. Like, are we talking about the same guy here? Just want to make sure. And the Lord says to Ananias here in verse 15 of Acts chapter 9, "Go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel, for I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake." Got kind of the suffering part covered up to this point, that's for sure. You know, you read 1st and 2nd Corinthians and you read through the book of Acts, there's been some suffering already. We've discussed quite a bit of that. He will continue to suffer physically. But at this point, he's gotten the opportunity to bear the name of Christ before some pretty important people. And he's going to talk to Felix here, and of course, Felix was the governor of Judea at this particular point. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Felix. To start out off with, I want to kind of cover who he was. So Felix was the governor or the procurator of Judea. He ruled from about 52 to 60 A.D. One of the things he was well known for was being a horrible governor. Okay, he was not a good guy, as is usually the case with most Roman rulers. His full name was likely Marcus Antonius Felix. He was appointed governor of Judea about A.D. 52 by the emperor Claudius. And he was eventually recalled by Rome in A.D. 60 for being a poor ruler. So he, ironically enough, got 8 years of rule before they recalled him. Whole other story there. But Felix and his brother Paulus, they were freed slaves of Claudius's mother, Antonia. So both of these guys, they were favorites of Emperor Claudius. So they were slaves within their household, and then Claudius freed them. and then made Felix governor. Now, part of the problem with this is if you're the favorite of an emperor, you kind of think you can get away with anything. And that's exactly how Claudius approached his rule. This was a very unusual situation. Appointment to these high posts such as governor or procurator. It was really unusual for people who were once slaves and then freed. So Felix was in an unusual position. He had quite a bit of power and figured he had the ear of the emperor, so he kind of did what he wanted. Tacitus, who was a historian, he thought that his servile nature explained his inability to rule well. I think it's a little gentle, honestly. I think he was just, he had been a slave and now he's the man, and I think he just took advantage of it. Felix, as we talked about a little bit before, he had a reputation for cruelty. He had, through a lot of cruelty, eliminated bands of robbers. He thwarted organized assassination attempts. And he had crushed the rebellion mentioned by the Roman commander in Acts chapter 21. So let's go back to that real quickly, Acts chapter 21. So when the commander here in verse 38... he brings up this issue with the Egyptian. He says, then you are not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness. This is the revolt, that one of the revolts that Felix had put the kibosh on. And as we talked a little bit about when we were there, basically they rounded him up and killed as many as they could catch. You know, that's that whole Roman justice trial thing. Oh, wait, no trial, just kill him. So Felix was pretty brutal in his approach to rule. And we talked a little bit about this as well. Funny thing is that on one hand, he put down some organized assassinations and then paid for assassinations to be done by the same people that he had put the kibosh on, the Sicarii. They were known as knife-wielding assassins, as we talked about. And Felix was the guy that was responsible for killing the high priest Jonathan, which then paved the way for Ananias to be the illegitimate high priest, as we discussed as well. And of course, if you know anything about this particular history and time, there was the Jewish revolt between 66 and 73 AD. A lot of the reason that that had occurred was because of Felix's governance, because he was a very oppressive ruler, didn't like the Jews at all, and because of that, he was partially responsible for really fomenting a lot of this division that ended in the Jewish revolt. So Felix, as I mentioned, he was much like other Roman governors of Judea. He was pretty anti-Semitic, or you could say Roman-centric, that, you know, Rome first, and everybody else had better fall in line. He was pretty typical of Roman rulers at the time. He was, not surprisingly, a very immoral man. We won't get into all the details, but just a few things here, and I want you to keep this in mind because this is going to have an impact on, I think, how he reacts to some of what Paul says. But he was married to Drusilla, who was the daughter of Herod Agrippa the First. Originally, Drusilla was married to Azesus, the Syrian king of Emesa, when she was 14, and then was, well, she later on left him, but Drusilla was reputed to be very beautiful. Felix persuaded her, when she was 20 at the time, to leave her husband and marry him. They had a son, Agrippa, who died in AD 79 in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in Pompeii. I thought that was kind of interesting. Felix later married the great-granddaughter of Antony and Cleopatra, who was also named Drusilla, and then later married an unnamed woman of some aristocratic family. It's a little bit of debate about what her name was, but also, during his marriages, he was rumored to have had many affairs during all of his marriages. He was very much, in his own mind, a ladies' man. So he didn't have many problems cheating on his wives. And generally, historians agree that his choices in marriage were fueled by a desire to increase his political power and privilege, which is, you know, pretty standard for royalty in that regard. So, this is the guy to whom Paul's case is being presented. He's immoral. He's known for brutality. Kind of wants to do his own thing. Has been able to do his own thing in a lot of ways, and Claudius just kind of turned a blind eye to it. So keep that in mind as we read through some of the accusations against Paul and then his defense. So any questions on that or any comments before we jump into the end of the book of Acts here? Sorry. Nope. All right. Acts chapter 24. Let's read the first 9 verses here. This is basically the accusations against Paul. This is where the prosecuting attorney, so to speak, will come and present his case. Okay? After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders with an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have, through you, attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But, that I might not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us, by your kindness, a brief hearing. For we have found this man a real pest, and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. And then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our own law, but Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. By examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him." The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. Okay, so a couple of things here that hopefully immediately jump out to you is that it was Ananias, the high priest, some of the elders, and Tertullus who had made these accusations against Paul. This Tertullus, he was an orator. If you look in the King James Version or in the Rotherhams, that's how the word is translated. But basically, he would have been somebody who was skilled in the law and able to speak well. Okay? So this is approximately 5 days from Paul's arrival in Caesarea. This is important because Paul will mention a time frame when we look at his defense that we want to keep these 5 days in mind. So this is 5 days from when Paul arrives in Caesarea. This would have been just enough time for a messenger to be sent back to Jerusalem and for the accusers to organize and travel to Caesarea. Now, you think about it. If you're Ananias, the high priest, and you have this guy, Paul, who, according to the Asiarchs, and also according to the everybody in Jerusalem who are Jews, you wanted to silence, this was a prime opportunity. So I'm sure that they had had all of these things arranged ahead of time, or at least as much could be. So Ananias, the high priest, made the 60-mile journey with some of the elders from the council to supervise the prosecution of charges against Paul. Ananias wanted to be there to make sure that he could influence the decision as much as possible. Now, this was rather unusual. The high priest generally did not get involved in cases of the court when it involved Romans. So it was kind of unusual for Ananias to make this trip, this 60-mile journey. Tertullus, as I mentioned, he was a Roman attorney. He represented the council and, of course, the high priest. He would have had knowledge of the court system and been fluent in both Roman and Greek languages and was a skilled speaker. Now, keep in mind, the Jews didn't really have as much of a grasp on the Roman and Greek languages, didn't have as much of a grasp on the Roman legal system. They knew what they needed to know, but they needed somebody else to basically represent them, and Tertullus was the guy. So, if you look at his opening statements, in verse 4 there, or sorry, verse 2 and 3, I find it interesting that Tertullus starts out by flattering Felix. This was the pretty standard approach. It wasn't written into law. It wasn't like, you know, if you're presenting your case before the court, you shall, you know, flatter the judge. But that's exactly what Tertullus does, because it was very much traditional. You wanted to flatter the judge as much as possible to get him on your side. Okay? He mentions much peace here in verse 2. Since we have through you attained much peace. That's quite a loose definition of the word peace, if you understand who Felix was. But he most likely referenced the suppression of the bandits and the Egyptian insurrection. Those are the two things that he was known for doing, what you could consider a positive sense. Now, if you go back and you look at some of the other historical writings and information on how these attorneys would present, this initial opening could sometimes take up to an hour, where they would flatter the judge for an hour by basically repeating everything that they'd done well. Didn't have a whole lot to say here, because Felix was not a good governor. But he mentioned the things that he could, with the understanding of trying to get him on again on his side. As we've mentioned, Felix's record was pretty bad, as we talked about. Wasn't something that there was a lot that he could add to. So Tertullus adds what he does, flatters him as much as he can, and then begins to list the charges against Paul. I find this interesting. He's a real pest. What was it that they were trying? What was it that the Jews were trying to do to Paul? Do you remember what their intention was? They're trying to kill him. So he starts out with, he's a pest. Okay. That's quite the initial volley, you know. He's a real pest, or plague is another word that's used in some of the translations. He calls him a creator of dissension among the Jews throughout the world. Now, in my opinion, this is where he should have started, because what was the Romans' job in relationship to the Jewish religion or to the Jewish nation? They were to keep the peace, quote unquote, peace. And so this causing up of dissension, or this causing of division and riots, if you will, was really, in my opinion, the primary charge that they were bringing forth. He references this as being something that he does around the world. If we go back there to verse 5, he says, "For we have found this man a real pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among the Jews, among all the Jews, throughout the world." I kind of like this. Because if nothing else, it shows just how successful Paul had been in his missionary journeys. Enough that that Ananias, the high priest in Jerusalem, would give Tertullus this information because it had come to him. So Paul had been pretty successful. It just bolsters how successful he'd been in preaching the gospel. And of course, we know that it was the Jews from Asia who had initially stirred up the crowds. If we jump back here to Acts chapter 23, Acts chapter 22. One of the things that Paul brings up here when he makes his defense before the Jews, this isn't in my notes, it's just something I wanted to bring up here. Remember how he begins this in Acts chapter 22, verse 1? He says, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense which I now offer to you." Remember how we talked about how respectful Paul was to the Jews that were there, to the ones who had brought forth this riot against him? You know, Paul's always respectful when he addresses these people. Now, he's hard on them when he needs to be, but if you go back to Acts chapter 21, verse 27, this is where you get these Jews from Asia. Verse 27, he says, "When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him." You know, it's interesting to see in the way that I look at this, that Paul's always respectful. And his opposition really never is. They try to use their power and influence to silence the spread of the gospel and to silence specifically Paul. But at any rate, we know that the Jews from Asia had brought these charges forth in Jerusalem, but they were really the ones who had started it. And Paul will mention this later on in his defense, because who was it that was there? Remember, these guys who were there, it was Ananias, some members of the council, and Tertullus. But none of the guys from Asia were here. They were the guys who should have been there to bring forth these charges, but they weren't. A lot of opinion on why that is, and we'll cover that when we get to the defense. All right, so the other thing that he mentions here in Acts chapter 24, in verse 5 there, he says that he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. It was interesting. We were having a discussion with some folks from the church who know somebody else who used to assemble here. And they used a word that I think you could, to equate the proper level of disdain when they call it sect of the Nazarenes, this particular person used the word cult. That they used to be in that cult. Speaking of us. This is essentially the level of animosity that they're describing when they say that he is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, it should be fairly obvious where they came up with this name, Nazarenes, but, of course, Jesus was from Nazareth, right? Okay, Matthew chapter 2, verses 19 through 23. I'm not going to go there because we understand it. But this is why, because it was a tie to Jesus. And remember what they said? What was the kind of standard Jewish approach to Nazareth? Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Huh. It was definitely not a very nice way of describing the Christians. And of course, along with this, they claim that he tried to profane the temple. Verse 6. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. Okay, I thought the wording here was rather interesting. He tried to, like as in they had prevented him from doing so. I found that rather interesting because they didn't really have a case. They didn't really have a leg to stand on, but they had to present something, of course. And this would have been a relatively big deal in the between the Jewish and Roman relations because, of course, we know that Jerusalem with the temple, it was the center of Jewish activity. It was the center of the Jewish religion and the Jewish governance. And Jerusalem usually had a certain amount of conflict always under the surface between the Romans and the Jews. So bringing this up was a way of being able to bring their case across so that they could get Paul properly accused in their own minds. Of course, this is the false accusation that was brought against Paul by the Jews from Asia. Let's go back to Acts chapter 21, just to remind you. We'll just pick it up here in verse 28. This is the Jews from Asia. They see Paul. They lay hands on him and they say, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is a man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law in this place. And besides, he's even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple." So these are the accusations that were brought, again, by these Jews from Asia. Of course, false accusations. But to the contrary, we know that Paul had spent almost 7 days in a purification ritual. Acts chapter 21, verse 26. This is, of course, at the recommendation of the elders in Jerusalem. He says, "Then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself along with them, went into the temple, giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them." So we know that Paul very much respected the Jewish laws and tradition. He took part in a ritual, in a Jewish ritual of purification, in order to try to prove that very thing, to try to show that very thing. But, of course, we know their approach was not really to listen to the facts, but to advance their agenda. So, back to Acts chapter 24. They wanted to judge him according to their own law. You know, I couldn't find anywhere in the Jewish law, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, or somebody who knows better than I do about these things, but I couldn't find anywhere in the Jewish law where it says if somebody's accused of something, without proof, you stone them. I couldn't find anything like that. Exactly. They wanted to judge him according to our own law in defiance of that law or in violation of that law. And I love the way that they put it here, that Lysias, I love this one, verse 7 in chapter 24, but Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands. Go back and reread that section where Lysias shows up. He's got to bring two centurions and probably 200 soldiers because the mob is so bad and they're beating Paul that they're the ones, the Romans are the ones who brought much violence to stop this? No. I just find it ironic the way that this prosecuting attorney is bringing forth their arguments. It shouldn't surprise me, but it is very much the way that it is today. But, because remember, you look back in Acts chapter 21, we won't go back there, but in verse 31 it says, they were seeking to kill him. And that, of course, is a stretch in the law, as we talked about. And Lysias is the one who prevented the Jews from committing this violence on Paul and killing him without legal reason. Okay? So, in this particular section then, Tertullus calls upon Felix to examine Paul himself there in verse 8. And then, of course, the Jews jump in and say, yeah, that's right. All these things that he said are accurate. Okay? So, this is essentially the opening statements in the hearing against Paul. Yet the prosecutor's given his version of the story, a version of what happens. And then Paul will pick up his own defense here in verse 10. Now, we're going to compare these two a little bit this morning. And obviously, you're going to see some differences in the way that Paul approaches his own defense from the way that it was being portrayed. So let's go ahead and pick it up here. Acts chapter 24. We're going to start in verse 10. We're going to read down through verse 21. And we'll come back and we'll point some things out here. Verse 10. When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense, since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. Nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience both before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar. But there were some Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you and to make accusations, if they should have anything against me. Or else, let these men themselves tell what misdeed they found when I stood before the council. Other than for this one statement which I shouted out while standing among them, for the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today. So, anything jump out at you about this, about Paul's initial defense? What's that? Cheerfully. Yeah, cheerfully. Where was the flattery? Let's go back to verse 10. Paul responds, knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. That's it. You've been in your position for a long enough time. I'm glad that I can make my defense before you. Now, why would he say he was cheerfully making his defense? You ever thought about that? I mean, no. Paul knows who Felix is, right? So, cheerfully makes his defense. Super Dave?
That's another opportunity for him to talk about God and the gospel.
Yeah.
So he takes every opportunity he can, and he does it cheerfully.
Yeah. I think that's definitely part of it. But the other aspect to this, and I think that this is why Paul didn't really say anything other than you've been a judge for many years, is that Felix was in a unique position. You remember his wife, Drusilla? Was she Roman or Jewish? She was Jewish. And as a matter of fact, if you look a little bit more in a little deeper into the history of Felix, one of the reasons that, well, I don't want to get too far off the beaten path, but Felix was very well aware of the Jewish tradition and the law. He was married, after all, to a Jewish woman. So that was helpful for Paul. Of course, part of that is that being married to Herod's daughter not only gives him the opportunity to understand the Jewish tradition, but then he also would have been somewhat aware of Christianity. He would have been somewhat aware of some of the things that had happened in the temple. Remember with back in the early days of the church, even earlier than this, you know, 60-ish AD, 58 AD, there were things that had happened in the temple. Like, you know, the guy that was born lame, and then he speaks to Peter and jumps up and starts proclaiming the word of the Lord. Remember that, of course, this kind of important day on the day of Pentecost, and several thousand people were saved, and then the church continues to grow. So Felix would have been aware of some of these things, and I think this is partially why Paul was happy to be able to make his defense before him. And ultimately, I think Super Dave got it right. I mean, he's getting the opportunity to speak to some very powerful and influential people. Okay? So Paul continues his defending arguments here. There's two different sections to this, and there's a section in between there. So we're going to cover part one here in verses 11 through 13 in Acts chapter 24. He starts out here. He says here in verse 11, since you can take notice of the fact that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. How long was he in Caesarea by this time? 5 days. So he was not in Jerusalem very long. He was there for a week, and most of that time he'd spent in this purification ritual. And he's bringing this up, that he'd only been there for 12 days, well, ultimately because they didn't have any proof of him inciting riots or disputing with anyone or being in the crowds and causing them to, you know, causing this commotions or in the temples, in the synagogues, nowhere. And keep in mind that the last 5 days he's been under Roman custody. So Paul would have had to have been pretty good at what he, you know, being a causing riot to take part in the purification ritual and cause riots within only 7 days. I think this is why Paul brings it up, is that I was only in Jerusalem for about a week. Super Dave?
You got to remember, too, that you read it when he was in purification. He was in purification with some of the elders. Yeah. So, I mean, there's witnesses there. Whether or not they testified to the truth is a different story.
Right.
But there are witnesses that he was in purification.
Right. That's a good point. Because, of course, taking part in those rituals and making the proper sacrifices, he would have been in the temple and others would have seen it. So Paul's defense starts out with, you can ask around, you can find some witnesses, basically, and you're not going to find me doing any of the things that they've accused me of. There, back in verse 13, he says, nor can they prove the charges against, prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. There's no evidence to prove that Paul's been causing these riots and these issues. So then he kind of changes direction a little bit, and he begins to kind of lay in the foundation for being able to deliver the gospel here. Verse 14 through 16, Paul basically affirms makes the affirmation of his faith and his hope. He acknowledges one of the accusations against him. Okay? Remember one of those accusations? He was a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, right? So he acknowledges that he serves God according to the way they call a sect. So it's amazing how much a little piece of information can change your understanding of a situation. The way that it was presented, of course, is that the Nazarenes were nothing more than a bunch of rebellious Jewish people who were creating their own way and causing all this dissension. And Paul doesn't say, no, I don't follow that stuff. Because the way that it was defined was incorrect. So Paul says, hey, yes, I serve God according to the way they call a sect. Ever heard the term the way before? It's a commonly used term regarding or relating to the teachings of Christ. This term applies a number of times, or appears, excuse me, a number of times in the book of Acts. In chapter 9, chapter 16, chapter 18, chapter 19, chapter 22, here in chapter 24, and also elsewhere in the New Testament. A good example of that is 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 2. So the way is something that was very commonly referred to for Christianity, or used to refer to Christianity. And also, I think there's an interesting message here, if you need an idea for a message. The way is referenced several times in the Gospels in regard to the preparation for the coming of the Messiah. There's an interesting connection there, huh? So prepare the way of the Lord? Anyway, I won't go too much further into that, but it's mentioned in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay? So, Paul continues on and he says he believes all things written in the law and the prophets. Now, as we've worked through all of his missionary journeys, this is a common argument that comes up against Paul. That he's telling them to forsake Moses, right? That he's telling them to leave all that stuff behind. Well, Paul certainly has the respect, the proper respect for the Jewish writings and the law, but always doing it in line with the teachings of the New Testament, the teachings of the gospel. In other words, Paul understood very well that, I think somebody by the name of Paul wrote 2 Timothy, right? Chapter 3, verse 16, he says, the New Testament is the only inspired word of God and all the rest of it should be... No, he says, all Scripture is inspired by God, right? So Paul very much understood and very much believed it. And of course, we also see that Paul was willing to put himself under the law for the sake of the gospel. He writes that to the Corinthians as well. It's a well-known passage. So, he had been preaching and teaching about the law and the prophets, helping them to understand from the law and the prophets that Jesus was the Christ. Remember that. So, it's not like Paul could turn to, you know, the book of 2 Peter and flip it open and say, here, no, because it wasn't written yet. So, the things that Paul had been teaching were from the law and the prophets. And of course, he had hope in God regarding the resurrection of the dead, as he had proclaimed during his time before the council. I mean, this is part of the base Jewish religion, that this resurrection and judgment, right? So, he always strove to have a good conscience before God and men. How well did that work out when he said that to them before the council? They didn't like that much, right? But in this case, of course, Felix doesn't really give him much of a response. But then Paul continues on in the second part of his defense, in verses 17 through 21. So he makes the point that he came to Jerusalem to bring alms and offerings for his nation. Back to verse 17 in Acts chapter 24, he says, now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. You go back, and this is exactly what he had written to the Romans, right? Okay. Back in Romans, I'm not going to go there for the sake of time, but Romans chapter 15, verses 25 through 27, he actually mentions this. This was why he was going to Jerusalem. We know this as we talked about this particular subject through the third missionary journey specifically, that he's been collecting alms and collecting these donations for the church in Jerusalem. Okay? As they found him, back in Acts chapter 24 there, verse 18, says that he was basically found purified in the temple by the Jews from Asia. So they find him in the temple finishing up this purification process, and they're like, "Oh, he's blaspheming. He's defiling the temple." Which is not at all how they found him, but that's what they accused him of. There wasn't any kind of multitude, and there was no disorder. He was just doing his thing. He was following the law. He was doing the purification ritual, and he was paying the expenses for these guys when these Jews from Asia found him. And they're the ones who should have been there to bring the accusations against Paul. And as I mentioned, Ananias was there simply for the purpose of lending credibility to the claims against him. Now, this is almost trial by proxy, because the ones who were making the accusation weren't there. And instead, somebody of a higher level of recognized power was there, because the Jews from Asia didn't have a case against Paul. And so Ananias was there to try to lend some credibility to the claims that were being made against Paul. We understand that the council was eager to see Christianity snuffed out, and they saw this as an opportunity to press what they saw as an advantage. This is why Ananias was there. Okay? We know a lot about Ananias, and we've seen his behavior before, but he was not a good man. He was not a righteous man. He was a man who had power and wanted to wield it for his own good and for his own political power. But, I find this particular portion interesting, that the Jews from Jerusalem really could only find one thing wrong with him, and that was that he had made the statement that he did before the Sanhedrin council, and it was because of that statement that everybody got worked up. So I find it interesting that Paul admits, if you will, to a couple of the accusations against him. Number one, that he was a Nazarene, that he followed the way. And number two, that he got the council upset. And that was really the only riotous event in Paul's discussion with the Jews. So he, of course, makes this statement. And I love the way that Paul does this. He doesn't just say Jesus Christ is Lord and there's a resurrection of the dead and there will be judgment. He lays the foundation in there. He says, I am on trial for the same reason that these guys believe, because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. And this is what divided the council. So he's laying the foundation for being able to preach the gospel. All right. We'll stop there. Any questions, comments? Okay, got a couple. I'm going to go back and grab Nolan. I'll be back to grab you.
Yeah, just to add on real quick, too. at least in English, the word sect means to cut. Mm-hmm. When you think of, like, if you were to bisect something or dissect it, mm-hmm. you know. And it's actually short for a section. So it's probably why God allowed the name Christian to come about. So they've been called Christians for a while now. And I was talking with someone one time about this, and they said, well, secular history tells us that the name Christian was not a good term. It was not like, well, I mean, whether that's true or not, Peter is okay with the term. He says, if anyone in 1 Peter chapter 4 suffers as a Christian, okay, he is to glorify God in this name. So, the word Christian shows up in Acts in a couple places. So, but, you know, the point is, you have this consistent charge that keeps being leveled against the apostle of Jesus Christ that he's just a part of this section, this sect. And what's it being cut off from? Judaism. And you see how that plagues the churches, even in Acts 15 or Galatians and Romans, how just being a branch off of Judaism was falling short of God's complete picture of what Jesus came and the covenant that he's brought in. So by my estimation, it seems why God allows this name Christian to come about, because he's really trying to communicate to the world that this salvation is not something that comes from the Jews and is for the Jews. That falls extremely short of what Christ brought, and that it's from heaven for the entire world. So it is interesting to see over and over again that he's constantly being charged of being a part of this sect or this portion of Judaism. It's like it's just this little cutoff thing from what they're doing. And I just think it's interesting because, you know, he gets before Agrippa, and we'll see in the future, and then Agrippa actually uses the term Christian. So,
all right, Super Dave.
On his comment that he was on trial for the resurrection of the dead, you got to remember that the Sanhedrin consisted of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees believed in the resurrection. Sadducees did not. Mm-hmm. Therefore, when Paul made that comment that he's the resurrection of the dead, the Sadducees had a real bad problem with that, yeah. And it created quite a dissension between the two.
Yeah, and again, that's basically the only riotous thing that he might have caused, was making that statement. All right, you are dismissed. Thank you for your time.